previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
People assume that every case can be solved, but you don't always find the truth.
There are still things that we're not able to explain, and there are some questions that may never be answered.
Final appeal questions one mom's conviction, and there's something wrong with Aunt Diane questions another mom's diagnosis. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 39. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Blotter Presents. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and this is the Previously.tv suite of podcasts, True Crime TV Entry. I am joined once again by Annabeth Chow. Hello, Annabeth.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay. It does seem like the restless ghost of someone maybe doesn't want us to record this episode because the technical problems across two time zones that we have been having in order to discuss the things we're trying to discuss today. It's really kind of amazing. So if we seem rushed, it's probably because we are. Let's get into it. Here's our most wanted topic. Final Appeal premiered last Sunday on Oxygen. Here is the case file. Patty Pruitt claimed that she awoke to a loud noise one night in her Missouri home and was sexually assaulted by an intruder who later fled the scene. When she checked on her husband, he was dead from a gunshot wound. Her adulterous affairs were put on trial and she was convicted. Nearly 35 years later, exoneree Brian Banks and former prosecutor Lonnie Coombs are teaming up to seek the truth in Pruitt's case and others. So basically, this is unlocking the truth, but the non-MTV version. Brian Banks, I believe, spent 5 years in prison on a trumped-up rape charge. Lonnie Coombs has 18 years of experience as a prosecutor, and they are looking into cases that the convicted people claim were wrongfully convicted. I'm not exactly sure who this show is for, although it does do some things well. Annabeth, what did you think of the show overall?
Overall, it was all right, but I do have to say that I fell in love with the host, or with Brian and Lonnie. I loved them. I thought they were great. Everything is very, you know, it's very well shot. It's super sort of prestige-y, but it's all like so dramatic.
It is very dramatic. There are a lot of shots of Brian in particular, like staring out the window of the car as the landscape goes by in slow-mo. Like, this is 2 hours TV time.
Yeah.
I feel like they didn't maybe need every minute of that, but his charisma is amazing, and they have really good co-host chemistry.
They really do. Yeah,
together.
I thought they were great together. And he's so like calm and concerned, and he seems so sweet. And yes, and he's always staring into the middle distance, you know, thinking about the injustice of it all. But I would watch it again.
Yeah, so would I, because it went in some directions that I didn't expect. In clip two, Brian is talking to Patty Pruitt. He goes to visit her in prison, and there's an interesting bit that she has. He asks her, you know, how do you do the time? How do you carry the time? So let's hear her answer in clip two.
I don't know what 30 years feels like, but I know what 5 feels like. How have you managed to survive 30 years of incarceration?
I'm not going to do the whole life sentence today. You have to do the best you can today. I know that probably sounds really trite and stupid, but you know, if you fall in that well, it's hard to get out. Because I've still got 4 kids. There's no giving up on my kids.
Oh, I thought that was really interesting. I've heard long-term prisoners say that before, like you can't get up every day and try to do the whole bid.
Right.
But I hadn't just thought about that perspective on it in a while. Here's another interesting thing about this clip. Did she seem like maybe a little bit off emotionally to you at times?
She did. At first, you know, she seemed so bubbly and warm. And then she would get this sort of vacant look, you know, like as if she was trying to pretend to be a human with emotions, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, that clip was very poignant, I thought. I believed her when she was talking, but yeah. Other times, I don't know. P.S. I have a really bad cough. So if I start like crunching from my lungs, I apologize to everyone.
It's just the restless ghost of Diane
really
Schuler, but we'll get to her. So basically they do a pretty good job laying out the two sides. Patty's side is that it was an intruder who did this. The prosecutor's side, of course, is that Patty did it.
Right.
Lonnie and Brian set up a whole like recreation scene, and you will see that at the top of the page. And on our Twitter account and Facebook at Blotter Presents, one of the visual aids is them recreating it. And just like, you know, Brian is holding this 22 replica, and like everyone's kind of crammed into this really small space. And then there's this scientist sort of like,
oh my, that whole thing was hysterical. I was like, what are y'all doing?
Yeah.
You know?
I know. But there are, okay, well, it's like kind of a complicated thing. Like they lived out in the middle of nowhere, and it was kind of like, well, maybe someone did see a car. But on the other hand, who would like go out into the middle of nowhere? Like it just seemed like such a difficult, right. Like a high degree of difficulty for a stranger murder.
Yeah, it was weird.
And then there's the fact that she didn't say at the time that she was sexually assaulted, which like, A, that's a critical piece of, like, if it's true, and if they can find the pajamas that she had on.
Right.
That could exonerate her if they can find DNA. And two, like, I have not suffered that trauma, and I'm not judging anyone for how they do or don't speak their truth about it. Mm-hmm. But once you're, like, arraigned for murdering
right,
your husband.
Right, when you say something. I don't know, but Lonnie had a really good point about that, you know, that a lot of times when you do have a sexual assault, you know, you don't want to say anything because I guess multiple reasons, either, you know, you're scared or you don't want the focus. She said something like she didn't want the focus to be on her. She wanted the focus to be on, you know, who killed my husband. So, I mean, I could understand both sides of that.
Yeah, well, yeah, let's hear clip three, because that's when Patty gets into her rationale for not speaking up about that, at least at the time. I'm still not clear on whether she never told law enforcement.
Yeah, me neither.
Or whether she just didn't do it at the time and this murder occurred in the mid-80s. So let's hear clip three and then we can discuss more.
He was laying on me and he was wrestling with his belt buckle and my pajamas. It was all such an awful.
Were you sexually assaulted?
Yes, I was, but I didn't say I was.
When is that?
I don't know. I just didn't feel like I wanted to tell him that. I wanted him to find who killed Bill. I didn't want to talk to him about me.
There are times here where she's like upset as though this happened yesterday. And it does seem a little bit, seems ersatz, or like that she feels like she has to have
exactly.
An emotion. While I sort of am not entirely relating to her response to this event, this seemed very sincere to me, what she just said.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And again, I'm not sure if she ever said anything or if she only said it after she was convicted or what. But I'm hoping that, you know, if they do have evidence of some sort of assault, then they can, you know, test it and figure something out.
Yeah. And there's also the fact, I didn't clip anything like this, but there is, I think a local reporter was basically like, look, she had had some affairs and she was convicted of that.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, they were like, she is in prison because of she's, you know, a slutty McSlutterson or whatever.
Right. You know? And because there is a big like whack of circumstantial evidence that in my view kind of could have been interpreted either way. And one of the show's weaknesses is that it can be a little bit disingenuous, I guess, about what evidence can and can't mean. Let's hear clip four and then let me get your take on that.
It's a strong prosecution case.
Well, this is Patty's property. So you're going to find the family's blueprints all over. And then why dispose of the gun right on their property?
And why did Patty tell them about the guns? If she knew that that was a murder weapon, why would she tell the police about it? I mean, the more you look into it, the more questions I have.
I mean, people point at police to evidence that they think police are going to find anyway all the time. Like, there are things that are brought into this narrative kind of evidence-wise that are like, I don't know.
Some of it was...
Maybe it's just because I watch so much of true crime, but it's like, well, that could go... Like, you can come up with a number of reasons why she would have...
And they clearly were... I mean, I feel like this is Brian's personality in the first place, but they clearly were like, Brian is immediately, you know, on her side. He's like kind of a conspiracy theorist. You know, there was one point where like a red van was following them when they were walking down the street in this Missouri town. And he was like, oh, my God, I think they took a picture of us. You know, this has to mean something. And she was like, I think it's just a reporter. And like it turned out to just be a reporter.
Yeah. And she's also like, this town has like 117 people. We're here with a camera crew. We just doubled the population of this town. Like, it's not unusual.
Of course, they're going to be taking pictures.
But then they're talking to... I mean, then you get into like, there was a drug problem at the high school and apparently Bill Pruitt like took it upon himself to be like Columbo. And so then there's sort of like the implication that he was killed to do with that.
Some sort of drug lord and, ring or murder. I don't know.
And then the one son's suicide is dragged in and like, was he feeling guilty about something?
Right.
And it was ruled a suicide, but was it really a suicide? And then everybody in the town is apparently making threatening calls on everybody else.
Yes.
Here's clip five.
Then after Matt died, I got this phone call and a man's voice said, your brother is a sign. Everything is a sign. Patty needs to keep her mouth shut.
Get out of here.
No. If my mom is supposed to be keeping her mouth shut, what about?
I mean...
Oh, my God. I love Brian.
I know,
get
me too. I wouldn't usually have that much use for this show, but then I just love that, like, he hears information that, okay, the soundtrack is telling you that it's important, but he's like, get the fuck out. And you're like, yeah, Brian.
He says, get out of here so many times. I mean, I was taking notes, you know, when I was watching it, and all of my notes are just like hearts. They're just like, I love Brian. I don't care about anything else.
I know. And like this one guy, okay, let's hear clip six and revel in the drama that this Gustin guy is feeling. He's the neighbor to whose he was a kid at the time, but Patty like grabbed the kids and fled the house and took him to a neighbor's house.
Right.
Mr. Gustin has been waiting a real long time to spread some mustard on his memory of this shit in clip six.
The door opens. What's the first thing you see when you look out on your porch?
Crying kids and a screaming, hysterical, pale-faced woman that I know to never have looked like that in my life. The look, of utter, I've lost my world. That is a sight in my mind that I will never get out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's pretty mustardy.
Yeah. Then he starts getting threatening phone calls like now in the present day.
Yes. I mean, everybody in this town obviously still has a landline, first of all.
Yeah.
You know, and they're getting all these weird phone calls. Man, I don't know.
And also, right after this, Brian's like, Gustin, I'm going to let you finish, but the same way pickup truck has driven past here like 10 times.
Yes.
He's like, I'm just putting that out in the room right now. And it was like I sort of love that Brian is totally, he's like 100 about the drama of the situation.
He is. I mean, in every scene, he is all about it. So, but he's so sincere. Like, I don't believe that it's a put on.
Yeah. No, he's not like Aphrodite Jones type of,
right.
Like, it feels very genuine. And eventually, I mean, there's a scene at the very end where, like, they finally come up with some evidence that's just been sitting in a storage locker.
Yeah.
Like, uncared about for close to 35 years.
Yeah.
And when they're reading the list of the stuff, oh boy. Like, then they have a meeting with with like the defense team, and everyone's very stagily like, I find this shocking for our justice system.
Right.
This is neither justice nor system.
Yes, exactly.
But before that, you have Brian and Lonnie having a like very cute Encyclopedia Brown moment together in clip 7.
Pajama bottoms.
I was waiting for you to say that.
Oh my goodness.
I was waiting for you to say pajama bottoms.
I literally just got chills in the back of my neck. Pajama bottoms of Patricia Pruitt. They have been there all this time. They have been sitting there.
Untested.
In this sheriff's department.
I mean,
pajama bottoms of Patricia Pruitt.
I know.
Yeah, they're adorable. So...
They are. They're what makes the show watchable, because there's something like fundamentally about this kind of show that's like, maybe it's just my naivete, but like that it has been sitting there all this time. Yeah. Nobody looked for it. Nobody requisitioned it. She's had attorneys, plural. Yeah. She has an innocence project at, I think, Duke working on her case.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, at that part at the end where you were with it was the attorneys and Brian and Lonnie. And one of them said, yeah, we asked for this stuff. Like, we asked for the pajama bottoms a long time ago. And everybody said, like, there was a fire or it was lost or whatever. So, like, what's the deal with that?
Yeah, that was pretty interesting, because usually you feel like, well, eventually someone was going to get around via the Freedom of Information Act to releasing whatever it is they say they've been looking for 20 years.
Right.
So this did feel, again, more genuine, but there's always that. Sometimes you feel like whoever pitches these shows starts with this reveal and what they're hoping for at the end. And then they like work backwards in the pitch to,
yeah, build a story like, around it.
Yeah, like provided that we get these pajama pants.
Right.
Who's like, then let's cast the host. I don't know. But I think I will keep watching this.
I do too. I loved it. I mean, it had its problems, but there was something about it that I really liked. So.
Yeah, this is much less sort of lurid than Oxygen. Both Oxygen and Investigation Discovery have, I think, been they're like, we see you, Netflix, and they're trying to like detrash themselves a little bit.
Yeah.
Not totally, Bridezilla. But yeah, I think this is like, it does have its issues, but it's also predictable enough that it's like, you'll know when there's some boring part where they're just like, it's establishing shots of the prison in winter and.
Right.
Now I can just go to the kitchen and get some tea.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, for a show about murder, it's very pleasant, you know?
Yeah. And very likable hosts. They don't seem like just attention hogs. They like each other.
Right.
They're very likable.
Yeah.
So that's Final Appeal. It airs. It's I think only 6 episodes, and that might have been the first 2, actually.
Okay.
That we saw, but it's on Oxygen's website. We'll link it in the show notes, and that airs Sundays on Oxygen. And now it's time for our cold case. We are discussing There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane. Talk about taking the pitch from the end to the beginning. Did you like text me and you're like, I'm still obsessed with this? And I was like, technically it's a crime. Let's talk about it.
Yes. I was like, I, for some reason, have watched this over and over. I'm obsessed with it for some reason. I don't know what it is, because there are much better documentaries in the world.
Same here. And it's not just us. I have had this conversation in the HBO documentary section of our forums at previously.tv several times. There's just something about this story.
Yeah.
That, like, it's like a poppy seed at the gum line in your brain.
It is. I think about it all the time.
Yeah. And I've been thinking about it, especially lately. I'll explain why in a bit. First, here's the case synopsis in case you're not familiar. In July of 2009, Diane Schuler left a campground in upstate New York after a family vacation. 4 hours later, she drove nearly 2 miles in the wrong direction on the Taconic State Parkway, eventually crashing into an oncoming SUV and killing 8 people, including herself, her daughter, and her 3 nieces. What caused this tragedy? What, if anything, was Diane hiding? And will we ever know what was wrong with Aunt Diane? Hateful Buncey has a strong theory. We will get to it later. First, let's hear from Diane's sister-in-law, Jay, who is possessed of some of the most delightful Long Island hair that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot. You can see that again in the visual aids, which will be on our social media. That's at Blotter Presents on both Twitter and Facebook. Here is clip 8, in which Jay sort of explains maybe why we're all preoccupied with this case.
I'm very big into mystery shows. I live for watching those. And even before this, that's all I would watch. And it's just ironic to me that I feel like I'm on one of them. I feel like I'm walking around and there's going to be like, this story is going to come out. I feel like someone's going to say 10 years later, it proves what happened. There's so much more to the story. Mm-hmm.
There's more to her story, particularly that she's married to Diane's widower's brother, right, who we don't see ever. Right. Right.
Yeah. And it almost seems like at times that she lives with Diane's husband. I mean, she is constantly there. Yeah. They're constantly together. I don't know. I have a theory about that as well.
I mean, I think she may be the primary caregiver for Brian Schuler, who at the time of the wreck was 5, and he did survive. He has some continuing issues, at least as of when the documentary came out in 2011. Right. Do you have a theory about what was wrong with Aunt Diane?
I vacillate between thinking, you know, between believing Jay and Diane's husband about, you know, something neurological must have happened. She had a stroke or whatever. And then thinking that she was just a really high functioning alcoholic, you know, because that shit happens. And you can hide that for a long, long time.
You definitely can. And you can. I think the autopsy results that they had retested, I think it was like, it's not inconsistent. Some of the markers of like long-term alcohol overuse, like it could have gone either way, yeah. I think, but at the same time, and then there's that giant bottle, like the biggest possible bottle of Absolute, which she had in the car with her, and she had 10 shots worth and had clearly smoked pot recently.
Right.
There's more on this in the New York Magazine article about the case by Steve Fishman. He appears in the documentary. We'll link to that also in the show notes. But here's Jay talking about what she managed to get out of Brian vis-a-vis what was going on in the car prior to the wreck. Here's clip 9.
I have tried to poke and prod and things. I'm curious. And he said, mommy's head hurt. She couldn't see. I said, oh, Brian, I said, mom, Aunt Jay, I told you her head hurt. She couldn't see. And I said, oh, and that's when the crash happened. And he said, and I flew out of the car like Superman. Since he came home from rehab and I started spending my days with him, the story's never changed. Never, ever changed. Mommy's head hurt. She couldn't see.
I don't know if you have had migraines. That's what mine were like. And at least during the first part of it. I've also had migraines in which, like, my head hurt, but it was more of a, like, language difficulty. Like, I was having lunch with a friend, and I thought I was making sense, but he was staring at me. And finally, I realized, like, whatever I hear myself right. say is not what he's hearing. And then recently, a family member had this, like, double migraine event, ended up in the hospital, and was, like, altered in this way that it was like he appears to be in there but is completely unable to communicate and is like not, they're like, who's this, pointing to
right,
you know, the spouse, and he would just say gibberish. Like, if her head hurt and she couldn't see, like, I can see her driving to, like, she couldn't see, I could see her being altered, I could see her driving totally crazy to just try to get home. And I can also see that she's like, well, if two shots usually takes the edge off these 10.
Right. Well, and she did stop. You know, she stopped and asked the guy at the gas station if they had Advil or Tylenol or whatever. So
yeah,
it's funny that you bring that up, because that's never mentioned once in the documentary.
Yeah. I mean, sort of, that they're like, well, the pain from an abscessed tooth could have been right. extreme. And it's like, well, yeah, but I just.
Right.
I don't know, like, looking at the, like, migraine cam that they use. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had migraines hit me while I was, like, on 95. And it's like, well, I guess we're at this rest stop until I can actually see
yeah.
anything. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's my theory.
That's a good theory. I mean, I don't think
that excludes the idea that she was a secret, you know, that she had substance abuse issues. It sounds like she was maybe not.
It sounds like she was troubled, they didn't have them, you know, or secretly troubled, which is why she sort of presented this perfect facade, I guess, you know, to the rest of the world, like the perfect mom and wife and everything else.
Yeah. And that sort of, like, cheery, controlling combo, which I think is exhausting since even, like, I only have half of that combo and it's very tiring.
Yeah, exactly.
And certainly no one, like, they're just very reluctant to admit that anything could have been wrong,
right.
Non-medically. And we hear a little bit about that in clip 10.
In forensic psychiatric autopsy, what we do is attempt to piece together the state of mind and who the person was at the time of the events in question. People are seeking to preserve her memory. At the same time, they want to find out what actually happened, because it's such a tragedy and such a mystery. And right now, they are constricted. The choices they have is to either accept her as someone who was bad, which they cannot, because that she wasn't bad in their relationships with them, or they're focusing on some medical event for which there was no evidence on autopsy. The problem is, when someone is being demonized, the tendency by those who remember that person is to try to make them into a saint.
Right. Which her husband does, I mean, for sure, 100% of the time. You know, I think Jay had a little bit, you know, she was a little bit less adamant about Diane being this sort of saintly figure. But her husband, for sure, you know, I mean, bless him, he never wavered.
Yeah. Well, and he ended up suing, I think, the parents of the nieces who were in the car, because Diane was driving
their van,
their minivan.
Yeah. I know, the whole thing, that left a real bad taste in my mouth, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there was something about, apparently he also sued, like, his own wife's estate to get, like, medical help, like, help with Brian's medical. But it's like, this is not someone who is an expert on optics. Let's leave it at that. But yeah, I mean, and this documentary also does a great job of conveying, like, because eventually Diane, like, her nieces are, like, calling their parents, like, crying, like, there's something wrong with Aunt Diane. She, you know, something's really going wrong right here. And people are calling 911, but eventually she, like her brother, Warren, calls her and on her phone and is like, he's like, just stay there. I'm going to come to get you.
Right.
But then she leaves her phone.
Yeah. She leaves her phone like on the side of the highway.
Yeah. And even if she had her phone and was like responsive, because at that point she's like not making any sense.
Yeah.
Like the powerlessness of basically everyone to do anything about the situation, which is definitely not underreported. And
yeah,
like,
I know.
I drive up there. Yeah. I drive in that area, like Westchester, fairly frequently. And it's just like, oh my God, like it's bad enough when everyone's sort of basically doing what they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. But yikes. And also a couple of these 911 operators maybe need to work on their professionalism. Right. Let's hear clip 11.
She drives this 1.7 miles at a high rate of speed, and you have half a dozen callers to 911.
State police, 911.
State police, you got a northbound Taconic. There's a minivan in the right lane going southbound.
911. Hi, I'm at the Taconic. We just passed 100 exit 100 feet. There's a car going like 70 miles an hour the wrong direction.
It was very surreal seeing it coming at you. So what you had to do was, you know, thank God there was nobody on the side. I was able to go over a couple of lanes as the van came by me. And I said at the time 70 miles an hour because it was speeding right by. Dead pin straight. That like pin straight. Wasn't doing this. Was dead pin straight. Right after it happened, that's when I called 911.
State Police 911.
Yeah, you got a guy driving south on a northbound Taconic Parkway. Ooh, my God, I was in the left lane. Just past Pleasantville Road. He's going like about out of hell. He should be already on the same parkway right now. It's a minivan.
State Police 911, where's your emergency?
Hi, I'm on the Constance. Hang on the storm now.
The van that's going southbound?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're going out for it.
I mean, I think even if they'd managed to like run her, I mean, what do you do? Once you find her, what do you do as law enforcement?
Well, and what really struck me was when the one guy was like, she's going like a bat out of hell. She's going pin straight. And it really kind of like,
yeah,
your theory about her just being like, oh my God, I cannot see. Something is going super bad. I have to get home as soon as possible. All the while not realizing she's, you know, going the wrong way down this highway.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm into your theory about the migraine.
Yeah. I mean, I don't not think that she had some issues, maybe with secret substances, but, and then they eventually, Liz Garbus and her team, that's the director, got amazing access. Like that Maron guy we just heard, like they found a lot of the people who called 911 and interviewed them on camera, the witnesses and stuff like that. And that guy, like, very evocative description. But then I think they also had they also got Werner Spitz to look at the autopsy results, and they just keep pressing and pressing him, like, but it couldn't it be this and couldn't it be that? And he's like, the problem is she had 10 shots of vodka.
She was high and hammered. Like, that's the, you know,
yeah,
that was part of the problem.
Yeah.
If not the whole problem.
And so here's clip 12. Unfortunately,
I just feel, which, you know, it's just me being my strong opinion, is as soon as they saw alcohol, it was all stopped. Okay, she was drunk, she was high, that's it. Categorize that, drunk mom driving five kids in the car.
What about the abscessed tooth?
The which?
Abscessed tooth.
An abscessed tooth.
Could that cause a stroke?
It doesn't.
Could that cause a stroke?
Yeah.
In theory, yes. But based on the autopsy, there is none that I saw on microscopy. A stroke is something like this. Right. And it doesn't cause alcohol
formation. But could that reading be a mistake due to other medical conditions that people don't know that she had?
It could, but the question of the alcohol will always prevail.
I mean, this is, I think, the central sort of compulsion of the story for me is that they're both right.
Exactly.
That Jay's like, once they saw all those substances on the talk screen, they didn't look at anything else.
Right.
And yeah. Spitz is like, well, they're not going to. It was fucking 10 drinks. Like, I mean.
Yeah. And
both those things are true. And it's really hard that you know, we're never going to be able to reconcile it. So,
right. I know. And I mean, if I ever have to hear the phrase abscess tooth again, I mean, come on. Like,
I know
that's a ridiculous theory, but they're clearly, I mean, the husband especially is just grasping at any straw he can because it's so tragic and grotesque, you know, that you don't want any of it to be true.
Yeah. And there's, I mean,
there's some,
especially since there is a living child,
right,
that you have to find something to tell him that's not this.
Yeah.
Like your mom wreckage was a monster emotionally.
Right.
Yeah. And, but I mean, Jay is like, I love Jay. Jay is all of us. Right. Clip 13.
I sincerely hope that you'll find peace with this.
I need like 100 cigarettes.
Me too,
that's
Jay.
That's a girl. Yeah, me three. Me threesies. Yeah. I mean, it's, if you haven't, listeners, if you haven't seen this documentary, as I was telling someone on Twitter today, it's not an easy sit. There is also some crime scene, like accident scene imagery that is roof at the end. So be aware, but you know, just, this is a lot. And if you've been in an accident or, you know, this could be triggery. It's not easy. And there's, I mean, it's just tough. It's really tough, but there's just something.
There's something
fascinating
something about Aunt Diane.
Yeah. And then on top of that, there's this, like, there are a bunch of central mysteries. It's like her mother left the family when she was 9. She basically was the woman of the house. The other siblings forgave the mom. She didn't.
Right. Yeah.
She would not talk about it. People thought the mom was dead.
I know. Yeah.
She and her husband almost never saw each other. Her husband's idea of, like, her opening up to him was to tell him that the gutters needed cleaning. Right. Like,
yeah, and that's another reason that I think, you know, if she did have some sort of substance abuse problem, it would have been so easy for her to keep a secret, you know, from her family.
Yeah.
Because she basically didn't have a family on her side, and she never saw her husband. So, you know, wouldn't be that hard, honestly.
Yeah. And when she did see him, like, on the weekends, she was, like, having him decorate the whole house and
yeah,
mow the lawn, and apparently, I mean, look, some people, when they get married, like, they enjoy being told where to stand, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But, like, could everyone please just be honest with themselves and each other about the desire to have children? Because then you end up with clip 14 if you're not forthright.
I told him he has to work on forgiveness about Diane because he does not forgive her at all right now for what's happened. And the reason why he doesn't forgive her is he said, I never wanted to have kids. And this is where I'm left right now. And she was supposed to do all this. I said, okay, well, it's all right to be pissed at her. You know, everyone's pissed at her. I said, that's okay. I said, but you're gonna have to work through it. And he's like, what's there to work through? This is my life. This is it.
Ugh.
I mean,
it's a tough one.
Yeah.
I know. Like, and he clearly has, you know, sort of an aversion to therapy. Like, when they were asking, is Brian in therapy? And he's like, no, why would he need that? I'm like, are you serious? This is a child who has basically brain damage, and his all of his cousins and his mom and his sisters are dead. You know, I would, that would be the first thing I would do.
Yeah, because of his mom. It's not like they were hit by a lightning bolt.
Right. Exactly.
And he's 5, like, of all the people to be left with a, like, physically impaired and traumatized 5-year-old. You've got this guy who, we all have our strengths.
Right.
Danny Shuler's strength is not sort of interacting honestly with himself emotionally, mm-mm, let's say.
Yeah. Or anybody else.
Yeah, no.
You know, he comes off so, I think, poorly in this documentary.
Yeah.
like, I love Jay, but I'm not into Danny at all. So,
yeah, no. And I don't know. I'm not 100 on her decision to sell him out as not having wanted kids in the first place. And now he's mad because he has to raise one. Like,
yeah.
Okay. She's probably pissed because she's doing it. Like, this was at the end of a monologue where she's like, could you do anything around the house? Jackass. I have my own job anyway.
Well, and you know, Jay, she doesn't mince words. So, you know, she also likes to talk a lot. So it might not have even occurred to her, like, this is a terrible thing for me to be saying.
Well, yeah, but I, this documentary does also do a good job of like, of expressing the idea that, like, in the wake of an almost unimaginable tragedy and like grieving a loss like this, there's also like just bullshitty frustrations on the day-to-day level that are in the wake of it. And that Diane's sort of superpower was like smoothing those over for other people and herself, possibly to her
detriment. You know,
ultimate detriment. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Well, look, if nothing else, I am relieved to know that it is not just me who occasionally just is drawn back to this movie. Like, well, maybe I'll see something now and have another theory and crack the case.
I do the same thing. And like when I'm, you know, looking on my Apple TV or whatever, like, oh, I'm going to watch something, and I'll open up like the HBO app. And it's always at the top because I've already watched it so many times. And I'm just like, oh, let me just click on it one more time and see if I can solve this murder.
I know. I really wish that it were a little more like judgy. HBO Go. But yeah, after a few times, there's like just a little pop up that's like, really?
Exactly. I know. I'm expecting a tweet from them. Like when Netflix tweeted about that person watching the Christmas movie like 18 days in a row. I know. HBO is going to be like, AB Chow, what is wrong with you?
I know. You too, hateful Puncy. Like, both y'all go outside right now.
Exactly.
Well, thank you for discussing this with me. And as we mentioned, it is on HBO Go. And HBO Go, as of this recording, will not judge you for watching it more than once. We hope that you'll come and discuss your theories about the case on our forums. That's previously.tv/forums. Annabeth, where else can listeners find you?
You can find me on Twitter at ABChao, ABCHAO, and on my now defunct website, abchao.com. if you want to see pretty pictures of rooms, but
and occasionally
else.
Of dogs.
And occasionally of dogs, yes.
Rooms with dogs. Thank you so much for being with us. Finally, tech problems notwithstanding, coming up next time, Tara Ariano rejoins me for American Crime Story. Plus, we got an interview with a reenactor who was on Bridezilla. And after that, Toby Ball returns to talk about the many upcoming Waco properties. I'm Sarah D. Bunting. I'm your permanent guest co-host, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. You can follow this podcast on Twitter and Facebook at Blotter Presents. And we will talk to you next time.
In a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.